Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest. And in this case, someone I knew from when he was a high school student in Berkeley, California. And I was doing some research. His name is Steve Wasserman. He didn't write or edit all the books behind him in the picture, if you're looking at the video version of this. But he is in his office at Heyday Books in Berkeley, a remarkable organization made really even more important by Steve being the chief editor or publisher. He'll go into the exact title. But it has a long history, particularly in the area of indigenous studies of indigenous people, printing material and so forth. It's a California base, and we can talk about that a little bit. But he has been associated with a good number of the books behind him. He's been a major, major editor. He was at Hill and Wang. He was at, Tell Us All. Tell us about your career, Steve, and your relation to those books behind you, and then we'll get to a lot of the stuff I want to talk about.
Well,
why the library? Show us the whole library.
Yeah, well,
it's amazing. This is all a personal library at Heyday Books.
Yeah, it's what can I say? I'm a mad and obsessed reader, and the more I read, the less I know, and I hope that my brain resembles something like a colander where the grid is so finely woven together that as I pour like sand through an hourglass, enough collects on the grid that I retain and hopefully prompts me to, you know, further exploration. But we should say I began to work with Bob Scheer. I was in my senior year at UC Berkeley, and I was seeing a woman who lived in the house that he lived in Berkeley, and his then girlfriend and this woman and I went to have a Chinese meal at the Yenqing in North Beach in San Francisco, and we went out to see Chrissy Everett and Billie Jean King play the Virginia Slims tournament, and we came back and we played chess and we smoked a couple cigars, and I went home, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, Bob calls me to say, you know, I'm trying to work on this book. I'm under contract for a book about multinational corporations, and maybe you could have coffee and we could talk about it, and maybe you could become a researcher for me. And I didn't even drink coffee then. I do now, 50 years later. And so we began a long association. I had 8 years before then worked as a kind of foot soldier in his campaign when Bob ran for Congress in 1966 in the 7th Congressional District here in Berkeley to try to unseat Jeffrey Cohealand, who was the Democratic representative and an apologist for Johnson's war in Vietnam. And Bob ran against him on a two-pronged platform to end the war in Vietnam and end poverty in Oakland. He lost but garnered 45% of the vote. 2 years later, Ronald Dellums won the seat and remained in Congress for the next 40 years. But Bob and I began to work on that book, which would be published in the fall of 1974 under the title America After Nixon, The Age of the Multinationals. And it was really one of the early explorations of a phenomenon that is now known euphemistically as globalism, but which we, in our spirited dissent, tended to a brand as imperialism. And I remember being in New York with Bob when that book was about to go to press. It was the age before computers. And Nixon resigned on August 9th, 1974. And it fell to me, the lowly researcher, to go through the page proofs and change manually all the tenses from the present, as in Nixon is, to the past, as in Nixon was. And I assure you that no task so tedious was ever so pleasurable.
Yes. But Steve, this is about you, not me. And as is supposed to happen in any mentoring, if I can take the title situation, you're supposed to reject your mentor or at least outgrow your mentor. Okay. So let me take you back to the books behind you. I don't want the modest Wasserman. I need a little establishment of your significance in American letters, okay? And you've had an illustrious career basically exhibited by those books behind you.
Yes, I went on to work. I seem to be someone who's determined to work every station in the publishing kitchen. So I have worked in magazines, newspapers, in no particular order. I'm the former deputy editor of the Los Angeles Times opinion section when they had an opinion section. I'm the former editor of the Los Angeles Times book review when they had a book review. I occupied positions as publisher and editorial director of an imprint at Farrar, Straus & Giroux called Hill & Wang. I was an editorial director of Times Books when it was an imprint at Random House. I was editor at large at Yale University Press. And then for the last nearly 8 years, I've been publisher of Heyday Books, an independent nonprofit publisher founded 50 years ago. This year, 2024, marks our 50th anniversary in business. No small achievement for a hard scrabble upstart publisher specializing in California history, issues of social justice, as Bob mentioned, indigenous native California affairs, and celebrating and defending the environment and nature. That's broadly speaking the writ of what I do today. And basically, I have been for the past 50 odd years the midwife to the birth of ideas of others. And also, it's been in some respects, an act of ventriloquism, because even on my best day, I'm always haunted by the conviction that there are others smarter than me, more gifted, who have writerly chops, who have fresher and more original notions, and maybe I can help them shape those arguments, try to find ways to cut through the noise of the culture and get attention for deserving work. That has been the work of the last five decades. That's the work that I feel passionate about, because I'm somebody who believes ideas matter. Books can have an effect out of all proportion to their actual readership. And as they fall through time and circumstance, they have an authority, a moral authority even, that only time can bestow.
It's interesting you say ideas matter, because in your original days at the LA Times when you were working with me, we actually worked on a project on the Jews of LA. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because at the same time, and this has been criticized, not our work, but the other articles that were being done at that time, the longer form journalism that the LA Times was devoted to, where you had an article that started on the front page column left, but it all took over pages and pages. And they were great. That was a great contribution to journalism. But unfortunately, the paper indulged in what the current staff, which is now finally unionized and has found its own voice at the same time as they're having massive layoffs, so the future for print is no more promising, or ex-print legend journalism. But nonetheless, they critically analyzed some other major stories done when at the same time when we were doing the Jews of LA. In fact, I think we got the mandate to do the Jewish community in part because they were interested who lives here. And the Black community was described as, and the headline word was, marauders, or at least a lot of young Blacks leaving South Central LA and going to haunt Santa Monica and Beverly Hills and other places with crime and violence. And there was even a series of articles on the role of the liquor store in Black culture as a sort of unifying thing. And those two series at the Times didn't get anything like the critical evaluation from the communities that they were writing about. There was some, but they weren't as vocal as part of the Jewish community that complained about the series that we did. And I think a series that holds up very well. And it was at the time that Jimmy Carter was president. So I would like to talk a little bit about that now, since it's so much in the moment. However, I also want to point out, in terms of your description of your relation to writers that you work with on a very intimate basis, two names jump out: Susan Sontag and Christopher Hitchens. And in Hitchens' case, you had a much more intimate connection with his writing. And I think you should describe that a little bit, because it goes to your own independence as a thinker. And I've always admired this about you. And in fact, I had a rather stormy argument with Christopher Hitchens at one point, the relation to Bill Clinton and so forth. And you were caught in the middle. We made up, and Christopher actually gave me a party at his house with his wonderful wife, Carol Blue. And so we ended up restoring our friendship. But I remember you, in relation to both of those powerful writers, were an equal with them. You were very critical to their thinking. I had talked to both of them about your role. I know what I'm talking about. And yet you had your disagreements, and you were, as you said before, committed to getting the debate going, getting the ideas out, even ideas you might not have been totally comfortable with at all times. Is that fair?
I think that's absolutely fair. I met Susan Sontag in April of 1974 at a dinner at your home on Forest Street in Berkeley. I met her son, my age exactly, her son David Reif, who would become a writer in his own right. We're a month apart. We all became fast friends. And over time, Susan became almost a kind of anti-MAME figure for me. When I spent most of the summer of 1974 while working on your book, living at her apartment at 340 Riverside Drive, she had an apartment. It was the penthouse apartment, which had been Jasper John's, the painter's old studio. And I remember I had just graduated Cal the previous June, and I'm spending several months in her apartment. She was then living in Paris for the summer. So her son David and I had to run to the place. And I remember walking around this sparsely decorated apartment. There was an Eames chair, and a few dishes, and thousands of books, just like this, thousands of books. And I remember getting a crick in my neck looking at the titles of all of these books. Many of them I had never heard of the authors. Some I'd heard of the authors and never read. I had just graduated college, and I thought, my God, I just wasted 4 years. My true education begins now. Most engagingly was the clock near her bed, which was a 24-hour world clock that showed time zones all over the world. I said, my God, this person never sleeps. So intense and deep is her curiosity about the whole world that she's jealous of the other time zones. So Susan was a very inspiring figure for me. I remember plucking the journals of André Gide. There were four blueback volumes published by Alfred A. Knopf. And for totally mysterious reasons, I began to read them feverishly, really, in the middle of the night. And I came across a line that Gide, the great French writer, had confided to his diaries that I never forgot, which was that he wrote to himself, "I know I will have entered old age the moment I awaken in the morning and no longer feel outrage." And I thought that was such a great sentiment, that it was the capacity to be outraged by the way injustice and the things that we find in the world. If we ever lose the capacity for outrage, we're finished. We're finished. It will keep you young. And I thought there was real truth to that. As for Christopher, in October 79, on a first trip to Europe, I had saved my money, and I found myself in London. I went to look up a fellow named Robin Blackburn, who'd been one of the founding editors and contributors to something called the New Left Review, which was founded in 1962, which was an intellectual journal trying to revivify the left. And I had been very struck by the nature of the contributors and the sophistication of their erudition and their passionate engagement with all kinds of cultures, and their way in which they could analyze the economic, the cultural, and political circumstances of faraway places and even in their home countries. So I went, and he had written several op-ed pieces for me at the Los Angeles Times. So I went to meet him. We got on very well. And at one point he looked at me and he says, "You know, I know a guy. Are you free for lunch?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "I know a guy I think you'd get on with. He's the foreign editor of the New Statesman. His name is Christopher Hitchens." And he said, "I know a bad Chinese restaurant. We could all meet there." So we did. And the only thing I remember from that meeting was, yes, the potstickers were lousy, but the talk, but Christopher Hitchens was astonishing. And I I fell in love. I fell in love with this guy. And I invited him to write from time to time for the LA Times, and thus began a real friendship. I would ultimately introduce him to a woman that became his second wife, Carol Blue. Hey, everyone has agency, so I'm not responsible for what happened with the first wife.
Wait a minute, you distorted that. You introduced him to Carol Blue.
Yes, because I sent him out on tour in 1988, 89. I was publishing your collection of essays. I was publishing Jessica Mitford, bringing back into print her great book, Poison Penmanship, The Gentle Art of Muckraking. And I was bringing out Christopher Hitchens' first collection of essays called Prepared for the Worst. And it occurred to me, I'm publishing three generations of a certain kind of muckraking journalist, and we should put you on the road. We should have like a road show here. And when you, Christopher, and I think Alexander Coburn was there, as well as the moderator in Los Angeles at the Pauley Ballroom, Carol Blue was then living in LA, and I said you should look her up, and they began.
Well, that may be the story, but let me just throw my two cents in. As I recall, and I believe Carol Blue was working with me at the LA Times, and she had replaced you as my researcher.
Yes,
at your suggestion.
Yes,
you knew this young woman from Berkeley. Right. And then, as I recall, you sent her out to the airport to pick up Hitchens.
Yes. Yes.
And then Hitchens.
Yes, he was going to stay with her. I said he reached at my. Yes, that's exactly right.
But as I recall, at least the way Hitchens or somebody said this to me, he got back to deliver her to wherever we were supposed to be. And he said, I've just met the woman that I'm going to marry. And then you said something like, Christopher, you are married. There was a wrinkle in that. But he said that he instantly fell in love. I don't know. I don't want to make something up here. But that's the story I remember hearing. And I just to bring you into the story, we also had a big meeting. What is the place where famous L.A. for music, rock and roll, that your sister had access to? Or she was very involved in the music business. And that was one of the venues where we had our Bad News Bears forum.
That could be. I was not in L.A. to attend those forums. So,
but your sister is very involved in the business. And
yes.
I thought she was.
She was at the time she worked for, my sister Rena worked for Bill Graham. And she was the manager of the Wiltern Theater.
That's right. And we had our forum at the Wiltern, which I remember suddenly elevated, at least I felt elevated to rock star status, because people were telling me, my God, you're at the Wiltern. It's on the billboard. It's right up there, you know, and I can't carry a note. And I thought, wow.
Actually, I think you're conflating two things.
Probably. That's why I needed... why I needed you as a researcher.
Yeah, you're conflating two things. One was the promotion of your essay collection, Hitchens' essay collection, and Jessica Mitford's book. That was in 1989. But then in March of 2003, eve of bombs falling on
Baghdad, that's a big mistake.
Together an event at the Wiltern, which Brian Lamb of C-SPAN broadcast, the two-hour debate, which I moderated, featuring you, Mark Danner, Michael Ignatieff, and Christopher Hitchens, taking opposing views on the propriety, both morally and politically, ethically, and in every other way, regarding American intervention in what Christopher liked to call Mesopotamia.
Okay, this illustrates a point I want to make, because that was a really contentious debate. And in fact, our opponents, Danner had written a very important book on torture and the U.S. government, and we were the critics of government policy, and Ignatieff and Hitchens were defending going to war in Iraq and defending, basically, in my view, U.S. imperialism. And they turned their back on me at one point. I guess that's an Oxford debater thing. When I made a pointed criticism of their position, I guess they turned their back because they thought it was not in good taste. I thought it was because I was being particularly effective in unmasking him. Leaving that aside, we nonetheless had very profound disagreements about that and a number of other subjects. It did not, it encouraged rather than discouraged further exploration. As I said, when I wrote a book about the military-industrial complex, Christopher Hitchens and Carol Blue gave me a party at their apartment in Washington, and almost the whole group that was there were the new neoconservative friends of Christopher Hitchens. It was an amazing evening. We're breaking bread. It's a nice meal, and I'm in a crowd of people who think I'm the personification of the enemy that's weakening America. Nonetheless, Hitchens insisted on a civil discussion. It was very enjoyable. We explored the issues. And so I think I want to pay tribute to you as an intellectual. You always thrilled to the debate. You thrilled to the conversation. And I'm going to eventually, we're going to run out of time, but I guess we'll extend this as we always do. I want to get at a quality of the Jewish experience, which, because it's so much in the news now, and what it means to be a Jew. And at some point in life, Christopher Hitchens decided he was also partly Jewish.
He didn't decide it. He discovered late in
life
that his mother, who had committed suicide with her lover, and he was called to identify the bodies in Athens, he only later learned that she was Jewish. This was the family secret. He wrote a very profound piece for Ben Sonnenberg, published in Grand Street, about his discovery of his Jewishness, and that part of the family had come from Hamburg, and this was a profoundly revelatory experience for him. He was thrilled to learn this because he had always associated that part of the traditions of Jewish people who were attached to the notion, intellectual debate of Spinoza, of trying to seek the truth, of questioning everything, not taking things on their face value. A dispossessed people spread in a diaspora who were minorities and oppressed in almost every land they found themselves in. And that gave them a moral perch for which their outsider status could enrich their critique of both their predicament and also engage their empathies with other dispossessed peoples. So it was something that was very moving to him, very essential to his understanding of himself and his origins.
Okay, and I guess I stand corrected, but as I recall, when he made that announcement, his brother disputed some of that history that you just recounted?
I don't know what his brother's critique was, but...
As I recall, he said that it was more distant than that, or it was the relation, whether there was... Anyway, that's not my point. As I recall, there was some dispute about the lineage, but that is what you just said is the interesting point that I want to get to, because it's so much in the news. What does it mean to be a Jew, and who speaks for Jews? And I think that what you just outlined, and I think alludes to an atmosphere. Happens, full disclosure, before I ever met you, I never met your father and mother before, but they came from the same kind of working class, leftist Jewish environment in the Bronx that I had grown up in. Mm-hmm. And everything was contended. And in fact, in the series we did on Jews, and you have a new book coming out, I guess, in the early fall of essays. Of yours,
yes.
Right? This is a very far in advance. Maybe we can do another interview when the book comes out. But it contains very important essays. But one essay it doesn't contain, because you were the researcher rather than the writer, although, of course, you did a lot of writing. And I've always been, you're not my only researcher, but they've all made me look good. You probably were the most prominent of the crew. But on that one, you got really involved.
Yes.
And I remember at the end, and we could discuss that a little bit because it's relevant. Now we interviewed Lou Wasserman, we interviewed.
No relation, I assure your readers, unfortunately, although occasionally when I lived in L.A., it was useful not to correct someone at the other end of the line when you're calling for a restaurant reservation.
No, he was the most powerful person in the film industry at that point, and yet had aroused the ire of some of the official leadership of the Jewish community or the Federation type people who, because he had dared support Carter on his peace initiatives. And for Jimmy Carter, peace and understanding the position of the Palestinians remained a cause to now his last days. And he did get substantial support from some very prominent Jews, not the least being Lou Wasserman. That came up in our interview. Nonetheless, in that series, which started out just looking at this community, basically, of people like myself and your parents who had grown up in New York, come to L.A., what had happened to this whole Jewish experience of criticism, of concern for the other, of social idealism, of cosmopolitan values, and so forth. That was sort of one of our themes. And could it survive prosperity? And actually, we naively asked the question then, is there life after Israel? Because I can't speak for you, but I actually was of the, and I say naive view that peace might break out. And that, and we saw it later with Clinton, that there was a possibility in Oslo and the Camp David Accords and so forth, that actually there could be a two-state solution of some kind, an accommodation of two rival nationalisms that didn't have to be rival, what that would contain. And I dare say Lou Wasserman, probably the most prominent Jewish business person in L.A. And a civic leader, certainly endorsed what Carter was doing. And he made a flat-out statement saying, nobody's going to define being Jewish for me. I'll define that, you know, and I'm not going to take lectures. It was a rather explosive moment. But my point being, originally we got into some other myths about the Jewish community. Cy Hirsch had written a big piece in the New York Times about crime in the Jewish community, and the Korshak, and a prominent fixer and guy for the studios. And in the middle of our work, I went down to see our editor. I say, you got to give us extra time because we have to examine what the New York Times has written. So you and I went to visit one of the people that was supposed to have been a Jewish criminal or connected with it, Max DeBarber.
Factor.
Called in the English press, Max DeBarber, to make him seem. And we had a lot of that kind of experience. But the reason I'm bringing it up is right now, if you're a Jewish person particularly, of any political persuasion and whatever you feel about Zionism and so forth, you're under a lot of pressure to think about what does that really mean? And can a state of Israel, really speak for us? And am I, and then in the extremes, am I being anti-Semitic or self-hating or what have you if I dare criticize the state? And the reason I brought up that vote today in Congress, the Progressive Caucus basically rejected the argument that criticism of Netanyahu as the leader of Israel is an anti-Semitic act. And they said, no, we don't want to give a blank check to a government that he leads because he's a right winger and jingoistic and everything else. It's the first significant, really, break. But I want to take you back to a scene because you have such a great literary sense where everybody falls in. And I recall, and I don't know if you were with me or we knew how close we were then, but you wouldn't have been. You're too young. I recall a moment at the 92nd Street Y. And I had been in Israel and Egypt, and I was in the West Bank right at the end of the Six-Day War. And I remember having a feeling I'd been in Egypt, I identified myself as Jewish and, you know, and say, no, my father wasn't, or no, I'm Jewish. I was, went to Shul 1. I grew up there. But didn't have any problem. I actually talked to some Egyptian Jews who were still in prominent positions. Six-Day War changed a lot. And then I went over to Israel, and I stayed at, I believe it was Kibbutz Barzai, very much like the kibbutz that was attacked viciously by Hamas this time, made up largely of people who would probably call themselves peaceniks, people who were more on the left, who did believe in trying to find a connection to Palestinians. And I went over to West Bank and Gaza. And at that time, I had this experience in Israel of feeling at home. I have to admit that. I felt like I was in New York without the anti-Semitism, or without the, you know, because there was still lively anti-Semitism, in New York. And I remember feeling that Israel basically was being run by people who, I mean, they all seemed to know ramparts that I ran into, including very prominent people, you know, Diane and Alon and others. When I would be covering that, you know, more official Israel, they all that I ran into considered themselves leftists, some variant of socialism. The Labor Party had come out of that. They all rejected narrow jingoistic view. Now, people have told me I was naive and that my writing about it at that time was naive. Nonetheless, I felt at home with the survival of a certain international Jewish concern for the other, which of course showed up in the American Civil Rights Movement with the important participation of American Jews. Now you look at Israel and it's a totally different picture, where the more fundamentalist religion is critical and indeed a formal part of the government, a right-wing supported by very prominent right-wing Jews like the late Sheldon Adelman and others in the United States. The leader of Israel, and Netanyahu, actually came to the United States when Obama was president and challenged his peace initiative with Iran in the U.S. Congress, almost unheard of. And so I just went back, though, to a moment at the 92nd Street Y when, you know, I had put Ramparts into bankruptcy, and I spoke there. And at the end of the thing, an older woman came up to me. I was denounced by quite a few people, some of whom you know. And this woman came up to me, and she said, she pointed her finger in my face, and she said, "You're right. Don't let them get to you. Don't let them frighten you. You are right in everything you said." And she described this over. And I didn't know who she was at the moment. Then I realized it was Hannah Arendt.
Really?
Yes, it was Hannah.
Wow. Have you ever written of this encounter?
I'm sharing with you. I've mentioned it. I don't believe I did. Maybe I did. But
it's the first I hear this story.
Oh, okay.
Never heard this story.
Well, I guess I'm not a good name dropper or something. I don't know.
No, yeah, you saved the. You buried the lead, Bob. You buried the lead for decades.
It was very emotional. Trust me, I needed to hear something like that. I just put my magazine into bankruptcy. I don't know if you remember, but a number of our Jewish supporters pulled our money out. And
yes, including Marty Peretz, who bought the New Republic.
Yeah. But it was an incredible moment, because I did think that I was speaking out of a Jewish tradition. And that's why I'm going to bring you back to your parents, because you actually were raised, I think, in Oregon, right before Berkeley?
Yes. My folks left the Bronx, the block where nearby where you grew up, and they grew up in the Coops. And my mother
was across the street where the Russian Orthodox were a significant force. So, but yes.
Allerton Avenue and Central Park.
Yeah. Not Central Park.
Bronx Park East. Yeah. Allerton Avenue, Bronx Park East. And my mother was from Gun Hill Road. My father went to Christopher Columbus. And my mother went to Evander High School.
I went to Christopher Columbus, too.
Well, there you go. It's very distinguished graduates. Yeah. Yeah. But they came out west in 1952, June of 1952, my mother pregnant with me. My father came out to take a job with the Oregon Highway Department, building the rode from Mount Hood to Portland. He was a newly minted graduate of Cooper Union, which gave full scholarships. His father was a garment worker organizer, worked in the Ladies Garment Workers Union. And by day and by night, he wrote a column in Yiddish for the communist Yiddish paper, The Morning Freiheit. And he wrote fiction stories. His brother, thanks to the fierce immigration.
Did he write it in English or Yiddish?
Yiddish. My father's first language was Yiddish. He learned English on the playground at 6 years old when he went to school. Any rate, my parents moved out to Portland, Oregon in 1952. I was born on the West Coast. And I can say, so my experience is very different than you as a Jew. I have never in my life that I know, I'm aware of, ever experienced an iota of anti-Semitism or prejudice directed at me as a Jewish person. And we lived for a time in a small hamlet of 2,000 people in central Oregon called Madras, Oregon. And we were, to the best of our knowledge, the only Jewish family there. But my parents were not religious. There are no rabbis on either side of our family. I come from a long line of atheists who are proudly, even ardently and fiercely antagonistic to religion of all kinds, but have a very fierce pride in being Jewish. And this is something that many non-Jews have difficulty understanding, because they associate the notion of being Jewish as they might associate the notion of being Christian, which, you know, to be a Christian, you accept the precepts of Jesus Christ and, you know, into your, and you become a Christian. But the idea of Jewishness is sort of born in the DNA. You are born Jewish. Even if you become a practicing Buddhist, you are still a Jew. So what does it mean to be Jewish? This is a question that many Jews have always asked themselves. And for me, in the culture that I grew up, it had something to do with a term in Yiddish called Menschlichkeit, the idea of being an honorable, ethical person, about making the world better, performing tikkun, helping heal the world. It had more to do with Spinoza than it had to do with
Herzl.
However, I spent 15 years trying to convince a woman of my acquaintance, a very brilliant writer named Susie Linfield, who was interested in the subject. And finally, I acquired and edited, and it was published 5 years ago, a book that Yale University Press published called The Lion's Den, Zionism and the Left, from Hannah Arendt to Noam Chomsky. And it examines six exemplary people on the left, and through an examination of their lives and writings, tries to tease out the contradictions and paradoxes of the relationship of the left as it evolved and it developed over the 20th century with the whole ideology of Zionism, both in theory and in practice. So it examined in no particular order Hannah Arendt, I.F. Stone, the French historian Maxine Rodinson, the British New Left Review person Fred Halliday, and Noam Chomsky, and Algerian or Tunisian, North African, Albert Memmi, who wrote a brilliant book called The Colonizer and the Colonized. It is a book that was relevant 5 years ago. Circumstances in what Hitchens would have called the Levant and Palestine and Israel have made Susie Linfield's exploration of these issues even more acute and painful and necessary than it was before. But let me tell you a story that might go to the heart of this question about being Jewish, about Zionism, about the establishment of Israel. In September 1982, as some of your viewers and listeners may recall, there was a terrible massacre that occurred in Lebanon, carried out by the Christian Falange with the aid and abetting of the Israeli Defense Forces under the leadership of General Sharon. It was the Shatila Sabra massacres. And it was a terrible, terrible incident. And I was at the LA Times. I was deputy editor of the Sunday Opinion section. And I remember after those massacres, and visiting the LA Times was Prime Minister Shimon Peres, who was on the left He was probably one of the more liberal people in the Israeli government. And he came on a speaking tour of Southern California. And as was the habit at the Los Angeles Times, he was invited to a very elite luncheon that was comprised of about 15 people on the editorial board of the paper, the editor of the editorial pages. And I was included in this group. And I remember, and it took place at the Tony Tamayo room, which was kitted out with Breuer modernist furniture. Everything squeaked in that room. There was glass and leather and aluminum everywhere. It was very modern, mid-century modern. And I was seated. Perez was in the middle. Opposite him was Tony Day, then the editor of the editorial pages. Next to Shimon Peres's right was his bodyguard. And to that man's right was me. And throughout, the lettuce and the salads arrived, and we began to eat. And I could barely take my eyes off the man's neck. I kept glancing at the bodyguard's neck. This was the neck of a Cossack. This was a huge, he had a muscle, a neck. I kept looking at his neck, and I thought, my God, it's not a Jewish neck. 6,000 years of Jewish history for this? And it reminded me that one of the goals, maybe the chief goal of this settlement of Palestine and the creation of Israel in 1948, marshaling all the moral authority that could be mustered in the aftermath of the Holocaust that had decimated European Jewry. So it was thought by many people who applauded. So did the Soviet Union at the time, who voted for the establishment of the State of Israel, because this was going to be the national homeland for the Jews who otherwise were persecuted and were vulnerable everywhere. And the remnant of European Jewry needed to feel, as it were, to use words commonplace today, seen and heard, and to have a powerful state of their own so they could defend themselves against the assaults of anti-Semites everywhere. The slogan went out that Israel, Jews, should become a normal people in a normal state. And I thought, my God, I'm looking, is this neck the neck of a normal person? And, or is this neck almost a biological betrayal of everything that I was taught was sacred and noble about the Jewish experience, which was the sort of the yeshiva, the people of the book? So what was the cost of normality? And that remains at the heart of the paradox and contradiction of Zionism in the heart of the Middle East. And so all this, but hardly any of this matters in some sense, because you could argue yourself to your blue in your face about who did what to whom, when, and you could have near Talmudic discussions about this. What counts is the emotional attachment that peoples on every side, each of whom are hostage to fanatics and fundamentalists and extremists, but who believe with all their might that they have a near God-given right to this bit of desert, and they're going to squander their best, the flower of their youth, and their and the murderous rage to claim a right to live there. So now we have 25,000 and counting deaths, many of them women and children, a murderous vengeance, criminally prosecuted by a power-mad guy called Netanyahu, other extremists on the other side. And as the old slogan in the 60s had, war is bad for every living thing. And I see at the moment a pretty forlorn and hopeless situation here, because what Israel has done in its acts of vengeance is simply created, they have sowed the seeds for the dragon teeth that will arise. Every Palestinian will seek revenge down the centuries, and the place is cursed. Reason has taken flight. Sobriety is nowhere in the picture. And we have a fever dream of nationalist yearnings by two peoples who somehow cannot find a way to live together in peace and harmony. And the squandering of their national treasure, as I say, the flower of their youth, is a heartbreak for everyone. So, you know, the question of the endangerment of Jews everywhere, I've never thought that Israel or the state of Israel spoke for everyone. I'm an adept and a disciple of I.F. Stone, who said all governments lie, including governments that you might be attached for emotional and historical reasons. And indeed, in Israel, a greater debate has often occurred that is less permitted here in the United States. To go back to the Jews of LA, though, the thing that interested me when I was working with you on that series was less what Lou Wasserman's position was on with respect to peace and a just dispensation that would honor and recognize Palestinian hopes for statehood and square the circle with Israel's right to exist, if indeed it did have a right to exist, which is now in question by many people. It was then. Of course, as you'll recall...
Listen, I got to stop you there because that is going to be the sentence that's pulled out by whatever they're called, the Canary people or whatever. There are a lot of groups now that like to pick a couple of sentences and then show what this whole discussion has really been a denial of Israel's right to exist, or it's anti-Semitic. So let's interrogate that one statement.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's exactly why we can have a debate now. You raise any complexity and you're going, you know, the argument becomes simplistic and irrational. So what do you mean by that?
Well,
whether Israel has a right to exist. You mean as a Jewish state?
Yes. I mean, if the chant from the river to the sea is meant to say that Palestinians have a right to the land free of Jews, Judenrein, free of Jews, and that the Jews who are in Israel now, who are consider themselves Israeli citizens, are, as the current vernacular has it, simply either the progeny...
You meant the Palestinians, not the Jews.
No. Is that the Jews...
I'm going to stop editing you. Let's start all over. Tell me what you meant by that statement. Yeah.
I said the question of Israel's right to exist has been debated since Israel established itself in its war in 1948, right? 48, 49. And that question hangs like Damocles' sword over the entire existence of the state. And it is acutely painful and center stage now as a result of the events of October 7th and the ensuing violence that has occurred. No?
Yes. But
even without taking a position on that question, the question is on the table.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. Let me push this a little further. You said something very important. First of all, the drive for a normal life, and people should understand, at the heart of the condition of Jews in the Yiddish Pale, which was where most of Jews who ended up starting Israel or come from there, they weren't from the Arab countries, whatever you want to say, in the Arab and in Persia and so in Iran and so forth, Jews were not subject to the kind of genocide that was visited upon them by primarily Western Europe, but with a lot of support from Eastern Europe. Okay. And that anti-Semitism as this was the most destructive force in human history as a targeted force was a product of not of Islam or Arab world or Persian world, but of Western European experience and Eastern Europe. Okay, let's put the whole Europe. At the heart of it was obviously Germany and Austria and so forth. The irony is, and even though you didn't experience anti-Semitism in Oregon, anti-Semitism was quite strong in the United States. In fact, one of the things we pointed out in our Jewish series is the major social clubs in Los Angeles excluded Jews, which is why Jews felt they had to have a Hillcrest in their own golf course, because they couldn't play golf at the major golf course, and they couldn't be in the Jonathan Club. They couldn't be in the California Club. So, and I can assure you, as a kid growing up in New York, I was punched in the face of more than once because I was accused of killing our Lord or killing Christ. And it wasn't until I was working at Ramparts Magazine, a Roman Catholic literary quarterly, when I got hired there, that the Pope said we didn't do it, you know, officially, Pope John. Right. So this was not for your father's generation in New York, your mother's generation. It was live issue, and including at our Christopher Columbus High School, where not only did we think that Columbus had saved, invented America, and so forth, but we had to fend off anti-Semitic attacks from other kids. It was not unusual part of our experience. The desire for normal life, the words you use, grew out of the fact that Jews were prevented from leading a normal life. They were not allowed or very often to have land. They were not free in their total movements. That's why you had the Yiddish Pale. And there was hypocrisy in both the Soviet Union and the United States. It's not clear which one first recognized Israel, but they were the first two to recognize Israel. They didn't have clean hands. The Soviet Union had had some experiment in Birobidzhan and everything of a Jewish community, but anti-Semitism was a very strong force, particularly after the elimination of Trotsky, who was Jewish. And anti-Semitism was a feature of communist life. There's just no question about it. And it was also a strong aspect of life in America. And there were prominent Americans who even had sympathy for Hitler. That was not a dead issue. And Roosevelt, when I was growing up, when I would run into more conservative kids, they thought Roosevelt was Jewish, and they did a play on his name. So the desire for normalcy is understandable. It means you want to lead a life and not be insecure all the time, and yet pursue your religion, your tradition, and so forth. And it was also, as I say, a convenient cop-out for the rulers of England and the United States and the Soviet Union to embrace Zionism. Good. The Jews who are troublemakers, they're progressive, they're radical, they write too much, they think too much. There is a wonderful tradition, which you summarized before. They're a threat to our stability, wherever they are. Let them have a state of their own, okay? So there was a cynicism that underwrote this that Zionism could play on. Okay. The irony is, and that's what I began this discussion, the people who ended up going to Israel basically did have a legitimate concern about their survival. They no longer trusted Germany, where they had been felt quite secure up until Hitler. They felt assimilated, the German Jews. They felt it elsewhere, certainly in parts of Western Europe, despite anti-Semitism. So the irony that I encountered at the time of the Six-Day War is that I felt very close to the Israeli people. First of all, like even the kibbutz movement, which only represented 3% of the population then, produced about 80% of the top officers of the army, the people who actually led things and sacrificed. It was the center of an idealism. It was basically a leftist experience. The Labor Party, and with its allies in Mapam and Mapai and all this stuff, was basically, I felt as the editor of Ramparts, people were toasting me at dinners. You
and
know?
All of those people have largely become politically irrelevant over the last
year. Of course.
And they've been defeated.
As I always did in my career with you, I'm building on your original, on your work here. So I'm going to end up agreeing with you. I just want to make it clear to anybody listening, we're not denying that there was some need for normalcy.
No ethnic group in the history of the United States, despite the anti-Semitism that you rightly point out, certainly existed. But despite that anti-Semitism, no ethnic group has risen so far, so fast, and found prosperity and a perch in American life as the Jewish citizens of the United States. Famously, the cliche, you know, the sons of garment workers, the very fact that I became the literary editor of the Los Angeles Times, my father, a first generation American, my grandfather, and on both sides, immigrants, they come to this country, they don't speak English. Their grandson becomes the editor of the Chandler family owned Los Angeles Times, is an incredible. It's like the first cut in Kubrick's film 2001, where you have the ape throwing the bone into the sky and it becomes a spaceship. I mean, no ethnic minority in the history of America since its founding ever enjoyed so rapid a rise into the highest reaches of American life in almost every sector, despite the anti-Semitism.
This is like a discussion. You know, we could really, when your book comes out, I'm going to really have a good long podcast with you, because we had some very interesting discussions, and they quite often reflect even a generational difference.
Right.
Because actually, I would argue the ethnic group that had the highest rise were the German Americans, non-Jewish German Americans. Jewish German Americans did very well.
Yes,
they did very well. But still,
the interesting thing about our Jews of LA series, that this was a triumph to the extent that Jews became powerful in LA. They battened on Hollywood. They were outsiders. Neil Gabler, in his book, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, is at the center of that story. What was interesting is that the Jews who came from the Pale, your grandparents, my grandparents, these were in contradistinction to the German Jews, right, who were the merchant princes and the financial.
They didn't want us. They didn't want us.
They didn't want us. Yeah. No, we would remind them of their messy origins, you know?
Yeah.
There was
no question about it. There was anti.
There was a difference between Los Angeles and New York.
Well, the irony is, you talk about, you know, your father went to Cooper Union, which was.
For Cooper Union, full scholarship.
Full
scholarship, of course. And I asked him, and then where would you have gone? He said City College.
Yeah, we would have gone to City College. We had very good engineering school. That's where I also went. But your father is very, very smart, was very smart, very good at what he did. And you don't mention he ended up working for Bechtel. He went very far.
It didn't come up, but I'm happy to mention it. At the heart of what my father wanted to do was a social consciousness. He wanted to build buildings and things for the masses. He became a hydroelectric engineer. At the time, it was thought clean energy, you get away from nuclear power, you dam up the rivers, you make, and it was like the Tennessee Valley Authority. This is clean energy for the masses. He thought these are beautiful things that could be built. And no, and I'll tell you one thing about Bechtel. You know, they never had a contract in Vietnam. I remember they never associated themselves with the war effort. On the other hand, yes, Bechtel helped build the pipelines with the Saudi royal family for the oil industry all over the world. They helped build oil refineries. Yes.
You know, it's a typical Jewish experience, because I remember having discussions with your father and mother about, you know, here I was running for Congress on an anti-war position, and I'm talking to your parents, who I really liked a great deal. And tremendous respect for them. And your mother was really sort of a pioneer in physical fitness for women and in their independence and assertiveness. And, you know, she did it for most of her life. But I remember talking to your father about Bechtel and, you know, basically, what are you doing with Saudi Arabia? And it's a typical shtetl Jewish conversation of taking every position, wandering around every corner of every argument and so forth. It was never boring. It was always open. Sometimes it got heated. But your father was very conscious of is he living a life of contradiction? Is this the right thing to do? You know, it was one of his defenses of not taking his success as far as he could. And as I recall, retiring at a relatively early age,
because he took early retirement at age 56.
Yeah, because he wanted to experience other aspects of life.
Yeah, so he became the president of the Berkeley Albany chapter of ACLU. He was a prominent member of the National Lawyers Guild. He slept in the headquarters of the National.
You should mention he went on to become a lawyer too, your father.
Oh, yes, and guess who financed that?
At night. He went at night,
yes.
Right?
And guess who financed his going to law school? Bechtel. He went to his employer and he said, you know, I'm bored. I think I should become a lawyer. And by the way, why don't you make an investment in me? Because I don't have the money. You don't pay me enough to go to. Why don't you make an investment in me and keep me employed? So he was 8 hours a day doing the job, then go to night school for 4 hours, three kids, teenagers running amok. When I look back on what my father did without complaint and seemed to extract joy, I never remember him coming home doing work, working on weekends. I never saw him break a sweat. If I could be on my best day, half the man my father was and half as ethical, I would die happy.
Wow, we could sort of wrap this up with that statement. Let me add a footnote to that.
One little prescriptive. All my rebellions, Bob, were against much larger, more impervious institutions. They were never against my parents, who always sought and did put wind in my sails.
And that's true in my case, too.
I remember your mother, Ida.
Yeah. And I think it's important.
Bobby, what are you talking about here? What is the contradiction here?
Oh, my mother. When I wrote my rather flattering view of Nixon, I don't think I can't blame you for that. I think it's a good article. But I wrote it for the L.A. Times. They let me write a retrospective when he was
in
ignominious retirement. And the only person that liked the article that I heard from,
right,
was Richard Nixon. It was absolutely amazing. The first person who read, this was my effort at objective journalism in the extreme. My taxes had been audited by Nixon. I considered him a war criminal. Nonetheless, I tried to step back and look at, why did he go to China? What did he really do in terms of ending the Vietnam War? What was his domestic program? He had embraced Moynihan's idea of a guaranteed annual income. He had done the Environmental Protection Agency. Nobody ever, to this day, mentions. It's a Nixon project. Nixon was a man of contradiction as well, and very much influenced by Eisenhower, who he had served as vice president, and was much more, by today, would be considered a leftist Republican in the extreme, Richard Nixon, compared to, you know, he certainly was not foreshadowing the federal government, and nor was he more of a warmonger than Lyndon Johnson or maybe Joe Biden, who's certainly establishing a record in that department now. But ironically, since we're talking about family and everything, my mother was living with me in Orange County, and she was, and this was a very long article, and I was home that day, and so the article came out in the L.A. Times. And my mother read every word with her glasses. You know, she was already 85 or something, reading. And then she looked up at me and she just said, only sentence. She said, he needs you. I'll never forget it. He needs you, you know. And I said, yeah, Ma, he does. Because if we're going to understand history, we have to be fair. Yes, objective. We have to really look in it. And I must say, taking it back to your parents, I had, you know, after all, they were my constituents. If I was going to be elected, I was politically active in the community, right?
Yes.
They were in Berkeley already, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so they were typical of the people in Berkeley that did support me, and a lot of questions. And is there a lesser evil? Should you be doing this? Is the guy you're running against Cohalen's so bad? I said a lot of questions. Or are you being radical enough? Or are you raising, they could attack me from the left, your parents, you know, as well as what's right and so forth. But I remember particularly with your father, because remember when we wrote this book about the multinational corporations, we actually, you know, okay, they do certain things. That's how you have Apple and Google now. We predicted this whole development, and Chinese multinational corporations building electric cars now and send all over the world, and the contradictions of a multinational corporation, one of which is you have to care about your consumers everywhere. That's why Apple wants to protect privacy from the NSA, because they got to sell these phones everywhere, something we discussed in our book, you know. But I wish you would write a memoir, because I think that is the generation of your parents who sacrificed. I mean, I knew of no, I was born in 36. I went right through the Depression and the war. and there was no group. Yes, there was the Nazi Stalin Pact, and you can go on and on. There was no group pushing harder for U.S. entry to defeat fascism, beginning with Spain, and certainly open the Second Front, which we did quite late. Talk about the concentration camps. They were in full force before we entered the war, and hardly any discussion of this Holocaust that was going on. It was an inconvenient truth to bring up, might divide people here. Everybody forgets we had a segregated armed forces, had a lot of contradictions. But I can remember being schlepped literally on, I'm going to take the train down to Washington to pick at the White House to get him to enter the war. And you know, the people sure. from...
When war was declared, my mother was the baby of her family. She had four older brothers and a sister. All the four brothers served in the Second World War. I never met the two eldest, Max and Sam. I'm named after Sam. Steve, I don't know how Steve got, they got that from Sam, but that's the story of the family. They were killed within, they were among the first to enlist. They'd been members of the American Communist Party. They had followed the events in the Spanish Civil War. They were premature, as the saying went, premature anti-fascist, and they were eager to fight Hitler. And they were killed within a week of each other. One of them is buried in Belgium. One of them is buried in a military cemetery in Arkansas, I believe. My mother has never gotten over their sacrifice. So yes, we shed blood in the war against fascism.
Oh, we had a war memorial in their old neighborhood, because where I grew up, we had a war memorial right there in the middle of the coops, and they put names on it and the gold star. But I do want to say half of my family were Germans. And yes. And one of the confusing things, my uncle in Germany, he was wounded in Stalingrad, you know, on the German army side. But the fact is, my German relatives in the United States, I know you and I have discussed this many times, were also premature anti-fascists, and because they were on the left. I yes. don't want to label them. Some were wobblies and some were socialists, like, more conservative, and some were communist. I think my Uncle Edward was, you know, I know my father was briefly and kicked out because he did a wildcat strike and got denounced by my Aunt Lily. It's a whole nother family chapter. But it's interesting. I was just talking to my, emailing with my nephew, my half-brother, all German, and he was in the U.S. Air Force because the Germans were allowed to fight in Germany. The Japanese, if they weren't in the concentration camp, they were, and I use that word, maybe it's excessive, but
it's precise.
A rounding up innocent, loyal citizens of your society based on their race or ethnic background is certainly fits that description, concentration. But nonetheless, my brother was trusted to bomb our home area of Germany. And he was in the U.S. Air Force, and he was entrusted in that. And I remember as a kid thinking of that contradiction, that the only thing that made my German family wonderful and decent and progressive, and my German relatives never allowed an anti-Semitic or a racist. That was a much more prevalent racist remark in their presence. And everything was because they came out of the left. No tribute is ever paid to that. The role of the left of various shapes, including a pacifist left, you know, A.J. Mustey, all of these people, but how important among white people they were to the civil rights movement and among black people.
I agree with you. I think one of the great stories, and I don't think it has, I mean, maybe I, among all these books, maybe I have just failed to read it. And I hope a listener will correct me and bring to my attention if it exists. But the full story of how the left, and yes, the American Communist Party, led the way on resisting racism in this country and was important in that struggle, has not really fully been told, not in the dimension it deserves.
It's only told as a negative story because the FBI went out to destroy Martin Luther King.
Told as a cynical ploy by these apologists this sort of fifth column doing Stalin's work in order to manipulate the legitimate desires of African Americans and to hold them hostage to this benighted foreign germ of communism. That's the commonplace thing.
Yeah, and the irony is at the university, when we still pay tribute to W.E.B. Du Bois, the fact of the matter is, and this is something that no one ever wants to talk about, he was 94 when he joined the Communist Party because he thought the Chinese were actually on the right road.
Yes.
And often, you hardly ever get. I want to end with one last thing. You have devoted your life to ideas. And when we did our Jewish series, and it was our series, I don't know, maybe you still, I hope you still respect it.
I respect it. I'm proud of it. And both of us had to go flee the city into near exile because we aroused such enmity and wrath that descended on both our heads.
Yeah, well, there was a particular rabbi who got upset because we said he played a lot of golf and his tan reflected that. And he got all angry and then he got driven out of his synagogue. Because of having too playful a life, let's put it that way. But the window, I think, I don't know if it was that time or was it about Cuba that the windows got broken and the people doing security told me, couldn't you write about some other stuff next time? You know,
but
I do want to say something. There was, and in fact, she objected. I noticed Vivian Gornick, who I have great respect for, is somebody I actually, I won't say romantically because we were young and it was a very limited couple of dates, but I knew her as a kid in the Bronx and we went to City College. I was a bus boy for a team of two waitresses and myself in the Catskills, where the biggest crime you committed would be to throw a fleischedicke spoon in a milchedicke pot, breaking the kosher tradition. You'd be fired on the spot and not able to get your tips. But nonetheless, when we wrote that series, we quoted Vivian Gornick from, you know, terrific. I mean, incredible writing. Nothing I've done could compare to what she's done. I have great respect for her. But she wrote me a note. She was objected because we ended the series with a reference to this Yiddish teacher that I had had and Vivian had at Shul One in the Bronx, Deichsel.
And Deichsel.
Deichsel was the first person taking this back to Heyday Books. Deichsel was the first person that I ever heard. We were playing cowboys and Indians. Even in a progressive neighborhood, we were killing Indians, okay?
Right.
We didn't know there were indigenous people. We didn't, you know, we accepted the whole modernization mystique everywhere in the world, that the industrialization would bring enlightenment. And we wanted machinery to come in, blah, blah, blah. But no one ever had a word to say about Native Americans that was positive. There were savages in the American Declaration of Independence, right? That's in there, American Declaration of the word savages. And Deichsel, this Yiddish teacher, teaching us Yiddish, not Hebrew, but Yiddish, the language of our diaspora, of our struggle, of our survival, an incredibly poetic, dynamic teacher, and she described him in her book as having this bony hand grabbing her wrist.
Yes.
And we quoted from her.
I remember the quote. Ideas, Dolly, ideas. They're the most important thing.
No, with them you have everything.
With them you have everything.
Without them you have nothing.
Yes.
Yes, now I've become your researcher.
You're good.
Yes, Deichsel. With them you have ideas. Darling, with them you have everything. Without them you have nothing. And to my mind, that describes what we were taught about being Jewish: the respect for ideas.
I you have my wholehearted agreement, and it's moving. It's moving to think so, and I hope that the life I've lived will have demonstrated fealty to that idea.
Say a good, and on that note, I want to thank, first of all, Steve for doing this. Laura Kondarajian and Christopher Ho at KCRW, the wonderful NPR station, FM station in Santa Monica, for posting these shows. Joshua Shear, our executive producer, who constantly tells me I've got to broaden my scope here. I think we did that today, with, even though it's an introspective look into our mutual history. I want to thank Diego Ramos, who does the introduction, Max Jones, who puts this all up in video form, and somebody we haven't talked about here, but you mentioned Grand Street and that wonderful literary publication that Jean Stein put out. And
she took it over from Ben Sonnenberg, who had founded it.
Yeah, and she kept it going. And
yes.
Jean Stein, who was a great, I would call her as a significant public intellectual, even though she didn't come on as the big intellectual. She came from one of the most important Jewish families, where Lou Wasserman actually worked for her father. But Jean Stein, since we've talked so much about what does it mean to be Jewish, was actually the first person that really persistently and in a profound way challenged my own naivete about Israel. And I'll use that words, those words advisedly. I indulged the notion that the heart of the leadership of Israel was in the right place, and that they were being twisted by events. And yes, their opponents had an imperfect record and engaged in violence of the sort. We saw some of their opponents in the start of this new stage of the war. And I always gave the leadership of Israel the benefit of the doubt. Maybe in some ways I did it out of opportunism, because you get a lot of heat if you dare challenge it. I think we're in a moment now where it is just simply deeply immoral for anyone, non-Jewish or Jewish, to give any nation a blank check, no matter what they call themselves. But as a Jewish person, and I do consider myself fully Jewish, and I notice the religious interpretation, if you have a Jewish mother, you are fully Jewish. So let me take that. And I just think this is a moment in which you cannot remain silent and still call yourself a Jew. I don't know. I mean, to my mind, that's obvious. I'll let you have the last word on that, Steve Wasserman, but I did want to finish my tribute to Jean Stein, because in memory of Jean Stein, we get some funding for this show, which I very much appreciate. I think this particular discussion acknowledges certainly my debt to her, and her through her friendship with Edward Said, a really important Palestinian scholar, and she introduced me to him and to his work. I really feel that a lot of my thinking flows from her persistence in challenging me on this very issue. I'll let you have the last word, Steve.
There's much that I agree with what you said, and there's aspects I don't agree with.
Who would want it any other way?
I would say that the hyperbole is not conducive to a sober and unsentimental look at the nature of Jewishness. I would not say that if you remain silent, you are not a Jew. I don't think you are. Jewish people can be silent and they can be outspoken. They can be racist. They can be self-hating. They can be ugly. They can be beautiful. They can be handsome. They can be on the side of the angels. All of them are Jewish.
Yeah.
Okay, so no, why, you're not.
Why, Steve? I can't let it go that way.
You cannot read.
Is it by birth? Is it by religion? Is it by?
It's not. Has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with birth. You're born into the tribe, and you are free to believe any cockamamie crap you want to. You could become a fascist, and other Jews will perhaps, I hope, denounce you for that. You could become a self-hating Jew and mask your identity and join the Nazi party. You're still Jewish, okay? So the Jewishness has nothing to do with your fealty to religious precepts, to something called Judaism, to whether it's conservative, reform, or anything, or whether you're agnostic or atheist. You are still Jewish. The nature of Jewishness transcends political position or religious theology. And that is a determination that the Nazis certainly adhered to when they put everybody into the ovens, no matter what they believed, no matter what their class was, as long as they were regarded as Jews, they were fit for the ovens. So I reject entirely this notion, if you remain silent, you're no longer a Jew. Let's condemn them on other grounds, but not on the grounds of ethnicity.
Okay, because... but
I take great exception to that. I think at least...
We should do a part two on...
Let me ask you a final question, Bob. Do you think that the state of Israel has a right to exist?
Ah, good question. I do, but not as a guaranteed religious majority. I believe in one person, one vote. I believe that all people are equal.
Okay, second question.
Wait, you asked me a very...
second question. Do you believe that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state?
I don't believe any state has the right to exist by an artificial majority of its sentiment and decision making. I think that's inherently an undemocratic idea. And let me persist a little bit here. I think alien to my notion, at the end of the day, it's up to anybody, whether they're a convert or actually anybody, to make their own definition of what this label stands for. You did it with a certain amount of energy just there. And let me say it's not the first time. Let me beg to differ. I think there are claims made on what that label means. There's a religious claim, for example. And it's not a simple one. There are different variations of Orthodox. The two main American worship standards or synagogues, the Reform and even the Conservative are not really accepted in Israel or without authority, or certainly without religious authority. But I do think for much of the Jewish experience in this world, and you don't have rabbis in your family, I have a long line of rabbis on my mother's side of the family. That's what my mother rebelled against. And she then rebelled against the Bolsheviks. That's why she came here after the Russian Revolution. My mother was a true free thinker by every standard. Nonetheless, there are different claims to what that word means. I think at the core of it would be some sense of obligation to a standard of truth or decency or values, whether you're coming from the religious or the secular, or the tribal. There's a claim that either through experience or through scripture or something, that there's some wisdom, there's some meaning. And I think that's why Jews show up disproportionately in social movements for improving society. I think there is a shared sense of obligation. You can call it tribal, a tribe that has suffered much, right? A tribe that has been forced to live often in a hostile diaspora. And so I don't think it's just a matter of mindless rhetoric on my part to say that all of these different Jewish groups, including the ones I very strongly disagree with, do make a claim to some essential Jewish values.
So, I get it. So
I know it's a trap.
If the logic of what you're arguing, and I understand it, suggests that it would not... Your notion that the claim of a Jewish homeland in the form of a state of Israel is not one you would embrace because it hollows out democracy and blah blah blah. So by the same token, would you not be for a Palestinian state?
Let me just go a step further. It not only hollows out that, it hollows out the religious notion.
Fair enough, but by the same argument,
let me just be clear about that for people who
establishment of a state the enshrinement of Palestinian nationhood.
But excuse me,
on the same basis on which you are deeply skeptical or even opposed the notion of a Jewish state.
Okay, look, first of all, and since we all believe in the rational and full discussion, I'm going to take this time now to engage in this because I don't want to go swapping slogans, okay?
I'm now, not making
no,
a slogan.
No, let me just be clear. First of all, the religious claim is also one that exceeds secular arrogance and says, you know, originally it's not supposed to be even secular people who decide where you have Israel. It's the return of the Messiah. But leaving that aside, I have no objection to a Jewish state when there's a majority of Jews, as long as they follow recognized international rules for the rights of a minority in any community. Yes, if you have, if Israel had not expanded and kicked out people in a Nakba and so forth, and you know, or if the Palestinians had just been there and there hadn't been this great flood of refugees and people coming in, yeah, I believe there should be a state for the Kurds, for example. I think I'm not opposed to Chechnya's independence or Georgia's, if you know, in that particular piece of real estate. I'm not a big nationalist. I'd like to see more of a one-world experience as implied by the formation of the UN. Nonetheless, I accept that I think you once used the word geography is fate.
Yes.
This also relates to population. See, I did learn from you, Steve, geography is fate. But I do believe, you know, yes, as a pretty good rule of thumb, whatever people happen to be living in a designated area, however it developed, if you follow the principle of one person, one vote, you prevent any discrimination, you guarantee equal human rights, and a majority of them happen to be Kurds or Jewish or Palestinian, and they vote for people that are sympathetic to that as long as not coercive, and don't have an established religion and follow basically principles of minority rights and so forth, I say you could call it whatever you want to call it as long as you follow those principles. The contradiction with Israel is that they favored a geographically expansionist policy. The Israel
we should belabor the point.
No, I just want to finish the thought. The Israel that I visited in 1967, at the time of the Six-Day War, was at least aware that it would fail as a society if it did not guarantee the Palestinians then living, whether they were Christian or Muslim, or anybody for that matter, others, there were other people living there, if they did not fully recognize, all the ones I talked to, their rights. Now, they weren't in the army, but that also would have to be. The Palestinians contributed blood to the Israelis, a number of them, in Israel. So the basic argument, you don't put the question, I think, properly. The question is, people can have societies in which one religion or one ideology or whatever is representative of a majority. We certainly have lived that in the United States with white, basically Anglo-Saxon people, basically Christian. But we have enshrined in our Constitution, and it's not always exercised fully, the rights of minorities and the principle of the fundamental rights, so human rights of every individual. So they can't have religion imposed upon them. You can't establish. If you ask me, do I believe in a Jewish state with religiously derived laws and going to rabbis to determine what laws? No, because that's fundamentally a denial of the rights of other people. If what you really mean is a state where a majority of people, not by coercion, by ethnic cleansing, by fascist repression, but rather they happen to be a majority of Jewish people, yes. If you're pointing out the contradiction of defining it as something called a Jewish state, meaning not as a description of demography, of the demographics, but rather the imposition of something called Jewish law or Jewish preference or Jewish favoritism, yes, I'm against it because it's fundamentally undemocratic. And so would the Palestinian state be, if that is that what you're talking about, would mean non-Palestinians vote matters less, or they their rights are not as important or equal, yes, I'd be opposed to a Palestinian state.
Well, we find ourselves in agreement on both these questions.
Yes, for the as when you were just younger, I thought you were out of high school. I guess you were out of college. I think I met you when you first were out of high school when you worked in my campaign. I may be
yes.
wrong. Yeah. But anyway, no, I don't mind. We've gone a little further with this last discussion, but I think we should leave it in. We could edit it out, but I think we should leave it in.
Do it as you wish. These questions beg... the answers are often elusive, but they hopefully we've been able to ask some of the right questions that challenge both our positions in ways that will deepen our thinking and give us greater insight, and perhaps that most elusive of virtues, wisdom.
Well, there you go, Wasserman, the pithy quote at the end that we can use. That's how you saved some of my writing. Okay. And
all
I've
right.
already done the thank you to everybody. So see
Sei
you
gesund.
With another Sei gesund. And look for Wasserman's book coming out in October.
Yes, called
Check
Every
Hate.
Called Tell Me Something, Tell Me Anything, Even If It's a Lie.
Okay. And check out Heyday's catalog. It's really a marvelous publishing effort. I'll see you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.